The Weekly Connect on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Weekly Connect here on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Stephen Scott.
And I'm Jill Barclay.
And we're here once again. Oh, do you know, last week's show was so much fun, we thought we'd do it all again.
Oh, well, why not? I mean, I thought I'd bring you into it again this week, Stephen. I thought I'd allow you to have a wee chat with me on air.
Oh, you're so kind. You really are. You're such a friend.
I know.
When I'm in need. We say we're going to do it again. We're not going to do last week's show again. We've got new topics this week.
We certainly do. And they're really, really interesting topics, actually, and quite topical.
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, it's this news that's broken over the past couple of weeks. Began with what was known as the Harvey Weinstein scandal, and that was, of course, all the news about sexual abuse and inappropriateness and things which have led to some careers being completely destroyed, and rightly so in some cases. But it kind of led me to thinking, and I put this to you this week, I said, maybe we should talk about this from the blind point of view, as in, not so much the sexual abuse side of things, because that's a very different thing, but maybe the unintentional consequences sometimes of people's help towards blind people, which can result in inappropriate touching. And it can also mean we can do the same back to people because we can't see them, so maybe we inappropriately touch. And is there a result to that? Is there an effect of that? And I thought we should talk a bit about it this week. And, you seemed happy to talk about it.
Absolutely. I think it's a really, really interesting subject because I think that, you know, from a conversation we did have earlier that, it's maybe deemed sometimes that it's okay for us to touch other people as blind people because it's more innocent. It's seen as being more innocent. But I don't think so. But we'll discuss our thoughts and feelings on that a little bit later on.
It's very difficult to start a conversation like that and then move on.
I know.
You just talk about it all the time. And the other topic we thought we'd talk about this week, Jill, is cooking. A favourite topic of yours, I think.
Well, one of them. I mean, if I'm not talking about makeup and clothes and handbags and shoes, then I do love to talk about cooking because one of my favourite hobbies is eating. But I do love cooking. And, you know, I love cooking for other people, but people seem to think that, you know, if I invite them round to my house for dinner, they're automatically going to get a Chinese takeaway.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Because they think you can't cook because you're blind?
Yes.
Right. Okay, interesting conversation to come then on that. And the third thing I wanted to talk about this week is expectations. And I think this is an interesting one because I think we have expectations of ourselves as we should. I think a lot of sighted people have low expectations of us. And I wonder about blind people to blind people. Are the expectations set by them? It's a really interesting conversation because it kind of brings up a lot of issues that we face.
It does indeed. And I've had this conversation before about, you know, what people expect of me as a blind person, what blind people expect of each other. So there is a bit of blind competition that can go on, so I've heard, so I feel sometimes as well.
Yeah.
And also, you know, the assumptions that people make when you can't see. So I'm really looking forward to covering all these topics.
Oh, so much to talk about. Right, okay, we have a guest with us, as always, and our guest this week is RNIB Community Facilitator Natasha Marcy, who joins us on the line via Skype. Hello, Natasha.
Hello, you all right?
First of all, what is a community facilitator and what are you doing here?
You dropped me in at the deep end. A community facilitator works for RNIB Connect and we basically help to signpost people to services in their areas or help them to create something that's not currently available. And why am I here on my day off?
I know.
How committed I am to you.
See, that's dedication to RNIB. Yeah, I think you deserve a pay rise, actually.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. Tell your boss about that one.
Scott, if you're listening.
Natasha, Natasha, are you blind yourself?
Yes.
Completely blind.
No, so I was registered blind from birth. I have Leber's congenital amaurosis.
Wow.
And I actually put up a post about this on the internet the other day because I feel like I'm quite lucky as the LCA community goes. A lot of the things I've read about it seem to just be that people have light perception and things, whereas I do have some useful sight. I've just sort of gone down there in the last few months using my cane in the public and things like that. So I'm still on my journey 25 years down the line. But Yeah, no, I do have some useful sight, but I am registered as blind. Yes.
Okay, so if I was to ask you what you could see, what would you respond? How would you respond to that?
People ask me this all the time. I tend to go with I have a really small visual field because my depth perception's poor, and my visual field is quite small, but sort of what you see at sort of 20 meters, well, not what you see, Stephen, but
not me.
What people usually see at 20 meters, I can see at about 2 or 3 meters, and I'm not very good at seeing in the sun, and I'm colorblind, so yeah. I got it all, and I've got a nice stagmus, so I'm not very good at concentrating on things.
So lucky white heather all around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm winning.
Yeah, we're nystagmus buddies, Natasha.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the best one to have.
It is. If you're going to have one of them, you may as well have that one. Yeah,
exactly. Nothing.
I feel so left out all of a sudden.
I know, it's like you've just been a gooseberry at a party all of a sudden. sorry about that.
That can come into... to topic number three. It's not a competition, Jill.
Yeah,
everything's a competition.
The competition started already. We're trying to say there's no competition. Right, okay, let's get into it then, because we have got these three topics to discuss, and everybody here has something to say on this, I'm sure. You know, and I want to move away from this big story, but it really was what sort of brought this subject to mind. It is something we've talked about before on the Weekly Connect, and we got some really interesting discussion around it, this idea of inappropriate touching. People who come up to us, grab us, pat us. I've been patted a few times on the shoulder. Once on the head, that was lovely. And I think I got, oh, that's a shame at the same time. So I really got the full package on that one.
Sorry about that one again.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, thanks, Natasha. Thanks for doing that. But, you know, that's it happens to us quite a lot. And I just wanted, well, it happens to me quite a lot. I want to know what you guys think. Jill, has this happened to you?
It has happened to me, but I don't really find it a big problem, to be honest. You know, I think if somebody is going to put their hands on my arm or my shoulder, or, you know, they're trying to get my attention, I am not one of those people that, you know, would be very offended by somebody. Now, don't get me wrong, if somebody came up and started stroking my face or started, you know, touching my lips or something, I'd think this is really odd and I'd ask them to stop. But, you know, I really don't see a problem, for me anyway, somebody coming up and putting their hand on my shoulder or putting their hand on my arm, because they're usually just trying to alert me to something.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. Someone alerting you to something. But if someone is talking to you, and while you're talking, maybe you're telling them a sad story or anything about your life, and they start maybe touching your arm or, you know, your shoulder, don't you find that a bit demeaning?
No, because I would do it back. I would be the exact same. If I'm sitting with somebody, whether they're blind or not, and they are telling me a sad story or they're telling me something that's emotional or that's maybe upsetting them, I want to show them the you know, I feel your pain or I feel your emotion. And especially if they can't see, I'd want to reach out and put my hand on their arm and give it a wee squeeze just to say, you know, I'm here. On the other hand, you know, if I'm sitting telling story, I might sort of, you know, sit next to one of my friends and kind of, you know, push them on the leg and go, oh my goodness, you'll never guess what happened. And it's just a way of me connecting with somebody so that I know where they are as well. It's about me knowing where they are. Now, whether they feel uncomfortable with it or not, I suppose at the time, I don't massively think about that. Nor do I massively care, if I'm honest. But if they did turn around and say to me, look, will you stop touching me, then I would care. Then I would think, right, okay, well, I'm going to stop doing that, because they're making their feelings known to me.
Okay, Natasha, what do you think?
I think I sort of agree and disagree in the same sort of way. I agree. I think it's a natural thing, especially in an empathetic sense. If someone's telling you a story, if you were sighted or you weren't sighted, you would tend to tap someone's hand or give them a little squeeze or whatever. I think that's the sort of natural thing. But if somebody came and just started manhandling me at the side of the road, I don't think I'd be very cool about that. I don't think that's a natural thing to do. I feel like if you present as vulnerable, people suddenly feel like they can just sort of move you around the street or drag you across the road or, you know, just sort of manhandle you around a shop, and that's not very cool. That's not okay.
But it's hard for us, though, isn't it? Because, you know, there are times when you don't intend to look vulnerable, but you end up looking vulnerable. You know, perhaps you, I do this quite a lot. If I'm, for example, standing waiting for someone, it has happened a few times, I've been standing waiting on someone and, you know, been on my phone trying to find their number so I can give them a call, see where are you. And then someone's walked up to me and said, oh, you'll want to cross this road then. And then they actually, on one occasion, took me across the road. I had no intention of going across the road, but there I went and ended up on the other side. And at the time, thinking, you know, I say I'm actually not crossing, but they weren't even listening to me. It was as if my position, my place in that particular situation wasn't really relevant.
I don't think, you know, it would massively bother me. I have been dragged across the road before, a road that I didn't want to cross, but instead of being angry about it, I actually take it in the kind of spirit of how it was intended, which is usually somebody doing their good deed for the day. And I know that sounds really patronising, but, you know,
I think it is patronising.
No, but, you know, when I was, you know, in the brownies, you know, we were always taught to, you know, offer an old lady a hand across the road or whatever. Now, I'm by
but
no
she
means
made it to the road, then can't she make it across?
Well, you know, it's just one of those things that, you know, when you're a kid, it's kind of instilled into you to help people. And really, what I would do is I would explain to them, look, I didn't actually want to cross that road, but thank you so much, anyway. Can you take me back? Just so that if there was anybody in the future that needed a bit of help, that particular person wouldn't be put off asking a blind person for help.
I get what you're saying there, but this is interesting. This takes me back to my guide dog training. I had a guide dog when I was 19, just for a year. It didn't work out for me. I was too young at the time. But I remember the training, and I remember near the end of the training, the trainer said to me, now remember, when you're out with this guide dog, you're an ambassador. And when, you know, someone comes up to you, like you say, someone comes up to you and offers you help, it's important for you to be nice to that person, because if you're not nice to that person, they may never help another blind person again. And my response to that, even at 19, was, okay, so let's replace the word blind with woman. So I said hello to a woman the other day and she wasn't very nice to me. So I'm never going to speak to a woman ever again. That's ridiculous. And I think, why should we not educate the public on the fact that we are different? We are all different.
Yeah, I agree with you, Stephen, but you can educate them in a nice way, because there is, you know, the feeling of embarrassment when you do get it wrong. So if you know, as a sighted person, if I was helping somebody blind across the road and they were offended by it, I would be so mortified. It genuinely would put me off asking somebody again, because I think I'm doing it all wrong. I think the best way to do is to handle it, you know, in a nice manner and just say, look, I really appreciate your help, but, and, you know, explain to them in a nice manner instead of, you know, I mean, I've heard of people shrugging people off and saying, leave me, or don't do that, or what do you think you're doing? And that, I think, is rude. I really, really do. I don't mean that people can come up and manhandle me in the street. I don't want that. I'd be very upset if somebody just come up and started kind of pushing me about and shoving me about, but I would expect somebody to come up and maybe put their hand on my elbow and say, do you want a hand across the road, or can I help you with something, so that I knew they were talking to me. Because there has been times, I'm completely blind, there has been times that people have come up and said, you know, do you need any help? And I've either said, oh yeah, that would be great, and they were like, sorry, I wasn't talking to you. You know, I haven't realised they were talking to me. I thought they were maybe talking to somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on my mood. And I feel like, you know, there's times where people come up to me and I won't want their help, and I'm just like, thanks, but no thanks. Like, I'm great on my own. And then it just really depends on my mood. Sometimes I don't want to be an ambassador for blind people. I don't want to be the face of blind people everywhere. And I'm just like, leave me alone. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want you to touch me. I don't want your help. Just, I don't want anybody in my space. I feel like I'm very British about it. Just don't touch me.
But like, that's an interesting take from that, because it again says that we are like everybody else. And I think this is the bit that people forget, that people see us out and about, you know, Jill with her guide dog, or, you know, me with my cane. And you use a cane, don't you, Natasha? Do you?
Sometimes.
Use a cane sometimes, right. So, you know, when you're using that visual aid, it seems to turn something on. If I walked, I always wish I could do this. I'd love to walk down a street, have someone film me walk down a street with the cane and then walk down the same street without it. And the difference is just incredible. Now, I get why, because people see the cane, they get it's an indication of sight loss. But it's the, I mean, there's inappropriateness that goes to the other extreme where people jump out of my way, grab children, run for your lives, all that stuff.
That's nothing to do with your blindness. That's nothing to do with your blindness, Stephen.
I knew it was me. But no,
I get the other way. Sometimes I forget I'm not using my cane. So I'll just be walking down the street and I look like anybody else. And then someone will cut me up and I'm like, and then I'm like, oh, hang on, they want to know.
There's that thing about appearance of blindness as well. You know, sometimes you kind of wonder, because I've been through this thing, because going back to using the cane, I kind of go through this. Sometimes you think, right, that person, say you're talking to someone and they think you're blind. They've just decided you're completely blind. And if you went to look at your watch, you'd feel at that point you've just defrauded the whole conversation.
It's funny you say that, because I love my sunglasses. You know, I've got really fancy sunglasses and a few pairs of them. But see, if I'm working my guide dog, I won't wear them because I think the sunglasses and the dog look too blind. I don't know if that sounds ridiculous.
Yeah, you're getting the hat trick.
Yes.
You might as well just have, like...
Exactly. So I only wear my sunglasses if I'm out with my friends, or if I've got, you know, maybe I'm in a beer garden or something, or I'm holding onto my husband's arm. But I don't wear my sunglasses if I'm working the dog on my own, because I think people think I wear them just because I'm blind, not because the sun is in my eyes.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I can't do my cane and my sunglasses. That's like a double threat.
You see, I have real problems with light perception, so I have to wear sunglasses. And sometimes, and this is the worst bit of all, and no harm to these, you know, if you want to buy them, it's up to you. But, you know, these eye shields that you get now, I've got a pair that actually go over my existing glasses, and I look like I'm about to go skiing. And I'll be honest, they're not fashionable on any level.
I don't think you really dig the sporty look, Stephen.
No, I don't. No, I look as if I've maybe had a skiing career at one time and then wandered into a chicken place.
Like broken a limb and now you've
just
gone.
Yeah. I had a couple of years out and it didn't really work and I've never been back. But yeah, going down the street with those on, and of course... Actually, you haven't really done the hat trick until you've got the sunglasses, the white cane or dog, and a white ear pod from your iPhone coming out of your right ear. The one ear pod.
Yeah, maybe you need like a luminous jacket as well.
Oh, yeah. You know,
or a Sam Brown. A Sam Brown.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. I forgot about Sam Brown. But for those who don't know what that is, Jill.
Oh, a Sam Brown is one of those things that you wear diagonally across you. It's like a yellow reflective thing that kind of buckles around your waist and goes over your shoulder like a seatbelt. And it is the single most embarrassing thing that I was made to wear when I was training with my first guide dog.
It's humiliating.
I'm sorry, I think it is humiliating.
It is humiliating.
You know, if somebody can't see me walking about with a guide dog, then they should have a guide dog themselves.
Well, the guide dog harness has got reflective bits on it. So if that's you'd see the dog, if nothing else, you'd see the harness. If nothing else. Anyway, look, we're drifting slightly away from the topic of inappropriateness. And I know this is something you kind of wanted to talk about anyway, Natasha, because public perceptions and the way people talk to us is a big issue for you.
Yeah, I just think people have this real thirst for knowledge about my life. Like, I'll get into a taxi and it's like, well, how much can you see? Why? Like, why? How do you do this? And like, I was on the bus this morning and this woman sat next to me and she's like, what's your friend's guide dog called? Does it do this? Does it do that? Can it open the door for her? She's like, oh my God, just leave her alone. Like, or ask her. Like, don't ask me. And like, or people are like, do you want to touch my face? No. No, never. Please don't make anyone touch your face. It's like an American movie thing. And I don't know how anyone allowed that to become like a common knowledge. That's what blind people do. They touch your face. They don't. I've never touched anyone's face. And I'm not about to start now.
It's the Lionel Richie video again, isn't it? The hello video.
Hello.
Yeah, all that again. The touching the face thing, I'm not into that. I mean, again, it's the movie thing. You're right. People think that, you know, if you... Blind people have to touch each other's faces. I've had people say to me, do you want to touch my face? No, you're too. All right, thanks. It's usually my response.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, depending on, you know, who it is, I will sort of make a joke out of it and I will touch their face and then I'll scream with laughter. So, you know, that usually kind of puts them in their place a little bit. I mean, it is
very Hollywood.
It's very Hollywood because other than knowing if they've got a beard and a big nose, and that's just the women, you don't really know what somebody looks like.
The women look different in out of Glasgow, you know, with less bits.
Yes, I have been to Leeds before I lost my sight.
Right, okay. We said we'd talk about anything on this show, but we're not going to start slagging off bits of Britain, okay? People in Leeds and Glasgow are both beautiful and ugly all at the same time. There, we'll just leave it there. Right, that's the balance on that one. Yeah, you know, I think it's an interesting topic because it does raise a lot of questions about people's perceptions of us. And I think ultimately, everything we tend to talk about, the same last week on the show, everything comes back to people's perceptions and attitudes towards us. And I think the whole inappropriate touching thing, people grabbing you and patting you on the shoulder, as I've had, and, you know, holding on to you when you're speaking to them, people holding my hands, all that stuff, it comes from this idea of we are little shames, poor people, you know. I mean, my classic, I will never forget this, getting into a taxi and leaving here one day. And the taxi driver said to me, "Oh, that's good. Did you enjoy your day at your club?" And I said, "Well, actually, I work there." And they said, "Oh, they gave you a job. That's fantastic." And I said, "Yeah, yes." I said, "I probably earn more than you." And he went silent. And I think, you know, again, Jill's right. You know, you have to watch what you're saying, but it is difficult. I mean, that's the thing, Natasha. It's difficult sometimes, isn't it, to
it's really hard. It just, if you're in a bad mood and then somebody starts with you, I have this inability to be really nice and really sweet and lovely. And sometimes I'm just like, no, like, back off. Like, just leave me alone.
But that's because we're human.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. Okay, well, I think we'll leave it there for that topic, because it is a topic I'm sure we could go on about. Like we all our topics here on the Weekly Connect. By the way, if you do want to get involved, even if you want to be part of this program, we'd love to have you on. If you've got something to say, if you've got something to shout about, maybe you've heard something Jill said and it probably will have riled you, then you can get in touch.
Beg your pardon. Yes, you can get in touch through our fully accessible website. All our contact details are there. It's rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
And you can even get in touch with us directly. The Weekly Connect at rnib.org.uk. Right, to cooking. I can't cook.
For me, cooking is not about me eating it. I mean, to be honest, usually by the time I'm finished cooking something elaborate, I'm so sick of the sight of it, pardon the pun, that I'm not even hungry anymore because I've been tasting all the way through.
Yeah.
But for me, it's about cooking for people I love, and I cook with love because I love my friends and I want them to feel satisfied. I want them to think it tastes great. I want them to leave with full stomachs. I want them to really enjoy the cooking. And I think when you love somebody, you know, you automatically want to feed them. That's why people come up to dogs all the time and say, you know, can I give your dog a treat? When you love something, or when you see something that you know, makes you feel in any way at all emotional, you kind of want to feed it for some reason. Or is that just me?
Well, I must love myself because I feed myself an awful lot. Natasha, do you like cooking?
So cooking is a real process for me at the minute. I am rubbish at cooking. When I make something, it just looks like, honestly, like you've already eaten it and just digested it. It's awful. But like, the idea of cooking seems lovely. And like, you watch the Great British Bake Off and like these lovely little puddings come trotting out. And like, they've had a nice little time cooking it. And I think, oh, that looks so nice. So therapeutic on a Sunday, whip out a Sunday lunch. And then I start cooking it and halfway through, I'm so over it. And it's just like, I just get really bored and just start slapping the stuff about. I'm like, wow, whatever. And yeah, it just comes out looking like a right dog's dinner. So yeah, I'm working on it, but it's a slow process.
I think you need to focus on one thing, you know, whether it be your starters, your desserts, or your main courses. I mean, you know, I can do a starter and a main course, but I cannot be bothered with dessert. Now, whether that's because, you know, I'm diabetic, it's never been a huge thing in my life. I tend to make a starter, a main course, and then I'll buy a dessert. or, you know, if somebody's coming around and say, do you want me to do anything? Yeah, bring dessert. Because I don't like making desserts. I cannot bake. I hate baking. So I kind of tend to focus on the savoury kind of main courses. That's the bit I like. So I think if you're not trying to sort of go all out and do, you know, three courses, then you're making life a little bit easier for yourself.
Okay, but hang on. Before we get into all of this, and I know we can, again, talk about this all day, but I just want to stop you there because you've just said blind people, you're both blind, you can cook.
Mm-hmm.
You've just blown a big myth out of the water. Because there are people who are listening to this who think blind people can't cook.
Well, I think people automatically assume that they're coming round to mine for a takeaway. And, you know, I don't mind that because in the end of the day, it kind of surprises people and they think, oh my goodness. And actually, I've had people watch me work around my kitchen and say, oh my goodness, it's mesmerizing watching you. You know, and it's nothing to do with what I'm wearing or how I look. It's to do with, you know, watching me chop something or, you know, not sort of amputating a finger or watching me cook something and not setting my hair on fire because I'm leaning over the stove or whatever. So, you know, people are genuinely fascinated by the fact that because I can't see, I can use a cooker and an oven and all these kind of things. I burn myself less than my husband does.
Does that not really annoy you though? Like you're some sort of zoo animal that people have paid to come and watch?
It's not that. I think it's more to do with, I mean, the way my kitchen setup is, you know, my dining table is just at the edge of my kitchen, which is in, you know, at the edge of my lounge, so it's a very kind of open room, so people watch me cooking anyway. They don't come round. I mean, I don't sell tickets for people to come round and watch me cook or anything like that. It hasn't got to that stage yet, although if I ever find myself jobless, but I think, you know, it's quite nice in a way, being able to educate my sighted friends in that, yeah, I can cook. They don't sit and kind of gawp at me. I mean, they get on with conversation, but they'll turn around at the odd time and say, oh my goodness, I've just watched you chop that onion. That's incredible. You know, I can't chop it that good. And then they'll get back to the conversation. So, you know, they don't tend to say it now. This is people that maybe don't know me coming into my house. But my friends all know now that I can cook and that I do cook and that I enjoy cooking. So for me, it's more of a compliment.
I think you've got an amazing amount of patience. I could put up with it, half of
only,
that.
Only for cooking.
Natasha, I mean, from your point of view, is it, do you think it's because of your sight that it bothers you, or is it just that you just don't really know how to cook? You like me, you just don't have a clue.
I think when I was I went to mainstream secondary school and primary school, and then I went to specialist sixth form. I didn't want to learn to cook. It just didn't interest me. I was 16. I wasn't bothered. You know, I didn't need to. All you have to do is put the hot water in the pot noodle, don't you, when you're done. I didn't need to know any more than that. And now I've sort of got to 25 and I think, oh, I should probably know how to cook more than I can. Like a lot of, and there's people, like some of my volunteers in my job, and they're like 20 and they're making a roast for 10 people. And I'm like, how do you do this? And I think like that inspires me to cook more than, you know, just anybody cooking. I think learning how to cook off people who are also visually impaired, I think is a lot more interesting and a lot more, I think like they've got a lot better tips and they can just say, oh, you just do that, this, that and the other.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I want a cookbook made by blind people who are just like, yeah, chuck that in until it's a bit chunky. And you're like, yeah, right, I kind of know what that means.
Yeah, because
like,
what does it mean when you say
glossy? And
what does brown the mince mean and all that? You know, it's like, yeah. I don't know.
The thing is, I think it depends whatever stage you are at in your life. You know, I grew up, I was fully sighted, Natasha, until I was 19, and then I lost my sight very suddenly. Now, I grew up in a house where, you know, my father is an amazing cook. I mean, he's incredible. Now, he's blind, he's in a wheelchair, he's got many, many, many disabilities and things wrong with him, and he's not a well man, but he still loves to cook and entertain. My parents, you know, were split up, but you know, my mum was a great entertainer as well and a fabulous cook. So there was dinner parties, things like that, and I loved the whole kind of pomp and ceremony of it all. I was never allowed in, but you know, I would do the dishes and then people would come through and hand me a fiver saying, oh, well done, good for you, and I made out of it. But at the same time, when I lost my sight, it was very important for me you know, I thought, I don't want to live at home again. I've been living away from home since I was 16. So I didn't want to go back home and live at home and stay there for the rest of my life. So I threw myself into learning how to do everything as quickly as possible because I wanted out as soon as possible. Mm. Now that I'm 40, you know, I'm at that age where, you know, I don't have any kids. I like feeding my husband. I like feeding my friends. You know, don't get me wrong, my husband cooks for me, I cook for him. But these are the things that I enjoy pottering around and doing. Whereas, you know, maybe when I was more 25 years old, like you, Natasha, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the next time I was going out to a nightclub and, oh, who am I going to meet? So it does depend at whatever stage you are in life, I think.
I feel like I'm buying a house now. I need to become a housewife.
But is there anything wrong with ready meals? That's my question. I mean, you know, yeah, decent ready meal, it's okay.
Can I tell you something? See, when I have been single and had nobody to cook for, there were nights where I just went home and stuck a microwave meal in the oven for one because it's all I felt like doing. I don't want to cook for myself. I want to cook for other people.
My wife's like that. My wife is exactly like that. If I go away for a couple of nights, if I'm away on business or whatever, she will not cook. She just won't cook for herself. She'll just have cheesy pasta or something. Mm-hmm. And it's like, you know, but when I'm there, she'll make this amazing meal and it's all this stuff. And that's great. For me, though, I think I agree with you, Natasha. I think it's about the school and it's about upbringing. For me, it was, I don't know what it was. And I'd go back to the point, I don't think it was about me being a guy. I think it was about sight. I was in mainstream education, both primary and secondary school. And in secondary school, I was told to avoid PE, physical education, and don't go anywhere near a cooker. You don't need to. It's okay. I was actively discouraged away from it. And that was because I was visually impaired. I mean, there was a lot. I have to say, and we're going to talk about expectations shortly, but, you know, I think that expectation thing drove a lot. And some people, in some cases, some people fight against that. I didn't fight against those two. I fought against the expectations about me being a secretary, which is what people thought I'd end up. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I want to work in this business. And, you know, I've made a nice career out of it. Thank you very much. But no, I never became a chef. I didn't fight that particular fight that day. And, you know, that's, I'm okay with that to some degree, but I kind of wish I was pushed in some ways to do more, like, you know, you were by your mum, Jill. I mean, my mum didn't push me that direction either.
No.
But I think that was because I was a guy in that case.
I feel like there's things there that I can do, so I can make a spaghetti bolognese, or I could make you a mediocre cake or whatever. But then there's stupid things, like I can't butter bread.
Oh, I hate buttering
bread. And I can't butter bread. And I'm just like, oh, come on. This is ridiculous.
You know, I get butter under my nails. I get it all over the place. It blobs at the sides.
There's always a hole in the bread. And like the filling spilling out the top. And people are like, oh, you buy a sandwich every day. You must spend so much money on sandwiches. Like, yeah, but I'm not dead. So.
Yeah, I've once found butter on a light switch in my house, and I still to this day don't quite understand how I managed to do that.
I think it was that time that your wife was trying to butter your head to get it through the door.
No, that didn't happen. Well married.
One of my friends is a product, I don't know what she's called, a product manager for Lurpak. And when she first started, I was like, I think what you need to do is have butter in a Pritt stick tube so you can just like spread it on bread.
That's a great idea.
Love it. I love
that. And she wasn't game at all.
That sounds like an American thing. You can imagine the Americans have got that.
Yeah, I just think it's brilliant. But
it's squeezy cheese.
So squeeze it in, yeah.
If you get squeezy cheese, you should get squeezy butter.
Actually, you can maybe have it in a kind of spray tan gun.
Yeah.
Butter and just spray your bread.
Like squirty cream.
Yes.
You right. Don't want to get them mixed up there. It'd be an awful hot chocolate.
Oh, yeah, no. Jill, give us some tips. Give us something that, because, I mean, you know, you're like a Nigella at the moment compared to us.
Oh, maybe in blind world.
Well, compared to us. I mean,
my biggest tip would be to listen to Ian Gentle, our blind chef on the Morning Mix, at around about 10 past 12 on a Tuesday. He is fantastic. So that's my first tip. I think the other thing is go by taste. Don't feel as if you have to follow a recipe. What I do is I will get the bare bones of a recipe, maybe if I'm watching something on telly, and then I just mix in what, you know, I think tastes right and tastes good to me. Obviously, you can't do that with baking. But when it comes to, you know, your bolognese's or, you know, things like that, any kind of ragu sauces you're kind of making, then it's all taste that counts. So you don't have to be too fussy about measurements and things like that. And taste as you go along. Don't double dip. That's horrible. Use a fresh spoon every time that you're going to taste something. But yeah, I mean, practice. It's just practice.
Okay. Well, Natasha, are you going to try cooking now? You know you've got those tips.
I need to. One of my volunteers is insane. She's the best cook, and I've been going around to her house for food, and I need her to teach me how to cook. So, I do. Yeah, maybe we'll see.
But it's like you say, having those tips given to you by someone who's in the same boat as you makes a heck of a difference, doesn't it? You know, because you know, when a sighted person comes around, I mean, I've had a couple of times where, you know, people have tried to get me interested in it, but they talk about it from their point of view, and they mean well, but, you know, it's again that whole thing about browning the mince and, you know, what it looks like, and you know, that means nothing to me, it doesn't make any sense to me. You know, if I've got something cooking in the oven, I don't know, I can't peek through and see what's in there and what's going on, I have to take it out, and in some cases you can't do that until it's ready, and how do I know it's ready, blah, 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 blah.
Well, the thing is, I think, you know, when it comes to browning anything, I mean, you have to brown it, but, you know, go common sense. You know, you're not going to brown it for 40 minutes, otherwise it's going to be, you know, horrible and overcooked and black. But at the same time, you can't brown it for like, you know, 30 seconds and expect all your mince to be brown. I think you've just got to go with it. And actually, if you leave something to simmer for a while, then, you know, it's going to cook through anyway. So don't be too caught up in browning your mince if you're going to let it cook for a while. The other great tip that I had from Ian Gentle, actually, was if you hate cutting onions and find it really impossible, buy do you know those afro combs that you get? Have you come across an afro comb? Buy a metal afro comb, put your onion down, half your onion, put it down, and then chop between the actual, you know, slide your knife between the actual holes of the, and it makes so much sense. I haven't done it, but I can imagine for people who do find it hard to chop an onion or something like that, that would be really, really easy.
See, I'm all about the making cooking as easy as possible. So, you know, I'll buy my carrots ready cut up. I'll buy a bag of frozen cut up onion. Done deal.
Yeah, exactly. Someone's done the work for you. I like that.
Yeah.
I'm
yeah,
lazy
that's
that
my
as
kind
well.
Of cooking.
But, you see, I bought a Magimix.
Ooh.
this is a whole other world to me, you know. It's an interesting topic. Again, the weekly connect at rnib.org.uk is our email address. You can also get in touch on the website. Jill?
rnibconnectradio.org.uk. It's fully accessible and all our contact details are there.
Right, let's move on and talk about our third topic today, which is expectations. Now, this is a big topic because we could very easily sit here for the next 20 minutes and talk about people's expectations of us. And I want to talk a bit about that, but I think we also have expectations of each other, as we perhaps rightly should. But sometimes those expectations can get in the way and actually not help. So I think we should maybe start with, let's start with other people first. Let's start with the sighted world and their expectations of us. Natasha, what's been an experience for you of someone expecting something of you because either they've seen someone else do it or... you know, they just have it in their head that that's the way to do it.
I think the usual ones are that you're either a Paralympian or you've got no job. It tends to be the ones I get that I get a lot. Like, if I get in an Uber or something to work, if I'm being lazy, and they're like, oh, are you going home? I'm like, no, I'm going to work. Oh, really? Oh. Or I get, what sport do you play?
Wow.
None? Like, come on, look at me. So, no, I think, yeah, people, especially after the Paralympics, people want you to be a superstar. And then when you're not, I think they get really deflated by your average presence. So I think, yeah, I don't know. You think that's my pet peeves, I would say. I'm not a sports star and I've got a job. Sorry.
How dare you? Okay. Jill?
Yeah, I think people do have certain expectations. For me, it's more kind of You know, do you have super hearing? Do you, you know, has your sense of taste got better? Don't think they realise that you actually just rely on it a little more. And that's why, you know, maybe, you know, you can taste things that maybe you didn't taste before. It's not so much that something has physically changed in your body. It's more to do with the fact that you are relying on that sense a little more. So I think people forget about that. In terms of what people expect of me, I mean, my mother put so many expectations on me as, you know, a blind person, as a sighted person as well. But she did make me feel that I suppose, you know, okay, you're blind, but you can do anything. You can do anything. And that is true to a certain degree, but I felt under so much pressure when I first lost my sight to be doing, you know, in quotes, normal things, and to be doing them as well or better than everybody else. I don't know if you guys have been put under that kind of pressure from, you know, your parents or your friends or your loved ones.
I guess for me it was the exact opposite, because at my school it was low expectations or no expectations. I was going to be a secretary. There was no point doing PE or physical education. That's not why I'm the size I am, by the way. I just choose to eat a lot.
Stop it.
But it's true. It's nothing to do with that. But, you know, it probably does have some kind of attachment to it. And, you know, any chance I had at doing what I wanted to do, just forget about, was pretty much where I stood at school. Now, I could have very easily fallen into the trap of saying, well, okay, that's fine. And there were others in my school who, that's the life they ended up with, you know, they just went with it and said, okay, I can't do anything, so therefore, and that was it. And fortunately, I fought against it and said, no, I will do this job. And I think it's because I already had something in mind. I think that was it for me. I had something I wanted to do, and I said, no, do you know what, screw this, I'm not going to become the person you say I'm going to become.
Do you see, I was made to feel like I was the underachiever because I only got a job, you know, chatting for a living. And, you know, that really hurt me, because I thought, you know, well, you know, I was expected to become a lawyer or a doctor or, you know, whatever. And that's not what was going to happen after I lost my sight. Now, I'm sure that if I'd wanted to become a lawyer after I lost my sight, I could have. I just didn't want to. You know, I was an air hostess before I lost my sight, much to my parents', you know, disgust, because they wanted me to do something high flying. Well, I was kind of high flying in a way. I was up in the air. And that's all I wanted.
Get much
to,
higher.
Yeah,
exactly. And I just wanted to, you know, travel and see the world and marry a pilot. You know, that was my ambition. Things changed when I lost my sight, but, you know, I had to work really, really hard, harder than my siblings have had to achieve what my parents felt were less, although I think I've achieved more.
Yeah, I think I've had a similar experience to that in a way. I think my parents have expected a lot less of me than they've expected off my brother. And like, they'll say things like, oh, well, you know, you've done a lot more than we thought you would when you left school or when you were born. And you're just like, oh, thanks. That's nice. Whereas that's not what you're saying at all. You're saying, you know, you're disabled. We expected you to be a bum. So I don't know, I feel like I'm trying so hard to meet someone's expectations when actually their expectations of me are probably just in the gutter.
But that's the point, isn't it? I mean, you, as you said, you know, you're either a Paralympian or you're in the gutter, and you're claiming benefits and you're taking from the state and all the things the papers tell the world that we do, that none of us do, by the way, on any of those levels. And it's interesting because we have exceeded probably the expectations set by others. Very interesting to hear your side of it, Jill, from the sort of opposite side of that. I don't know if that's because you lost your sight later on.
Maybe. I think
there was designs for you, kind of thing. And
yeah. My mother had designs for me, and, you know, in many ways, she was very proud of me, and she was, you know, she would tell her friend, you know, she's doing this and she'd do that, but she would kind of make it sound grander than it was. Do you know what I mean? And you just think, am I not enough? It's like I remember being at my mother's funeral and my stepfather talking to all his friends about, you know, my sister, the lawyer, and my brother that had studied politics at Edinburgh University, but not a mention of me. And I remember feeling really kind of hurt by the fact that, you know, I just didn't seem to exist in the family equation because I hadn't made it.
Okay, what about when a sighted person learns about something that a blind person has done and then tells us, well, if he can do it, then surely you can. That happened to anyone?
A lot of that, I met this blind person and they could do this. Can you do that? No. And then they just look super disappointed. I'm just like, I've let them down. I don't even know you. I'm like, oh, dear. But I haven't had that much, to be honest. I don't think people just don't talk to me.
Someone said to me, I had a taxi driver the other day who said to me, I had a guy in my cab the other week and he used a cane as well. He said, but he wasn't able. Basically, what happened was I got into the cab and said, the guy said, you know, what's your address? What's your postcode? And I said, oh, don't worry, I'll just direct you in. You know, that's okay. And that's when he said, you know, I had this guy in the cab, he had his cane, but he wasn't able to direct me in, so your site must be great. So why do you use the cane? You know what fascinates me about that? What gives him the right to ask these questions to me? And we get this a lot, don't we? I mean, we all get this.
I don't think there's anything wrong with people asking questions, whether they seem silly or not. I would rather educate somebody and tell them you know, this is the facts. This is why you need to do this with me and not that other guy. I think there is a lot of kind of blind competition that goes on between blind people as well. People trying to prove a point, which really annoys me because we all have our own level of capability. And some of us are more technical than others. Some of us are more, you know...
I'm more technical than you.
You're more technical than me, but I'm a better cook than you.
Well, you say that.
But, you know, I can't use a white cane. Terrifies me. So,
swings
you know,
roundabouts.
There's so many different things that we're capable of and we're not capable of. And I think, you know, I'd rather have somebody ask me the question so that I can tell them, actually, you're wrong. This is the facts. So that they wouldn't sort of maybe ask that silly question to the likes of Natasha, who would be a bit more kind of maybe... and amused by it. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts, like you say.
I don't mind people asking questions. I think we always have a thirst for knowledge and things that we don't know. I mean, I've always wanted to know what the back of Argos looks like.
Yeah,
it's
amazing.
Well. Yeah.
I want to slide down the chute.
Yeah, exactly. We always want to know things that we don't know or we think is going to broaden our horizons. And I think that's great. I love that people ask questions. And
yeah, but here's the thing, Natasha. Here's the thing. If you were to ask someone in Argos what's the back of Argos like, they'd look at you as if you just landed from Mars. Yeah. Because that would not be a usual question, whereas it seems perfectly acceptable for someone to walk up and say, oh, hi, how you doing? So what you can see? Can't you see?
No, yeah, I don't think people do that. I don't think people do that. Really? People actually just come up.
Oh, they do. Oh, yeah.
I usually find that is something that comes up in conversation, maybe with a taxi driver or somebody you're sitting next to in a cafe. I don't find people coming up to me and accosting me in the street and saying, oh, by the way, how much can you actually see? Or can you see at all? Or people will always approach me and say something about, you know, oh, that's a lovely guide dog, or, oh, you know, what's your guide dog's name? Or, oh, aren't they clever? Or can I pat your guide dog? Or
but I think that
there's
comes
always
from,
an opener.
That's so patronising, though.
It is patronising, but also I think that's because I think people go on the basis of guide dog equals blind. It's like cane, somewhere in the middle, could be blind, guide dog, oh well, you know, that's
proper
it.
Proper blind.
Proper blind, you're in there, yeah, you're in the club.
See, I think cane is more proper blind.
And, but that's the thing, but that's a different conversation for us. We could have that chat, and actually that could be quite an interesting chat, but I think people, their opinions and their perceptions go from, well, if he or she's got a dog, then, you know, they've clearly gone all the way with the blindness.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I just don't feel like, why do people need to ask me questions? Like, when I get in a taxi, why is how much I can see relevant to their day? You know, I wouldn't say, well, how much do you weigh? Or like, oh, well, what did you have for dinner?
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't say that to anybody else. Or, wow, tell me about your acne. Or, you know, how did this happen? You wouldn't say that.
That's after you felt their face, obviously.
Yeah, obviously. Like, whoa, it's dot to dot. You know, why, you wouldn't say that to somebody. So why is it now appropriate to be like, oh, your eyes moved, you're not on drugs, so tell me how blind you are.
Well, maybe it's because we are different. I mean, I feel, I get into a taxi, okay, and I do not want to sit in silence. I just don't, because I want to know from a safety point of view. I don't want to sit in the back of a private taxi, and it's not because I'm saying taxi drivers are, you know, in any way, you know, kind of. I just, for my own security, I want to know that if I want to jump out the car for any reason,
absolutely,
that I can just open, yeah, the front door. If I am going to, if somebody is maybe going a little bit over the top with the conversation or being a little insensitive or whatever, I want to know who it is I'm speaking to, because it makes me feel more comfortable in knowing who I'm in the taxi with. Now, I just do not like silences. I really, really don't. They make me feel really uncomfortable. So my blindness does come up a lot, because I may be talking to them, but I'm asking them questions. Oh, whereabouts are you from? Or you know, oh, how long have you been here? And, you know, do you like Glasgow? And, oh, you're from Morocco. My brother-in-law's from Morocco and I love Moroccan food. And it's just conversation to me. I don't see it as being intrusive. Now, don't get me wrong, there are days where I've had a bad day, I'm not feeling great, but I still would rather talk to somebody and have a conversation in a taxi than sit in silence.
Oh, yeah,
I feel so uncomfortable.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't suggest no one speaks to anyone, and not at all, but I just think it's, there seems to be an allowance that people have or think they have with us, and I don't know where it's born from, because you don't see this. I wish someone was on the show today who could tell me this from their perspective, who was in a wheelchair. Do people come up to them and say, so can you really walk?
No,
do you know what I mean?
You could speak to
that. Would be completely wrong.
How immobile are you?
Yeah.
Wouldn't say that to somebody. Can you walk half the time? And then do you have to sit down? You know, it's not cool.
I can tell you from my dad's point of view. I mean, my dad has got no legs. He is in a wheelchair. And he, instead of actually people coming up and asking him things, people ignore him because he's not at their head height. So they talk to whoever is with him, or, you know, and it's the complete opposite. He feels invisible. He feels really invisible. I mean, you know, you could talk to my dad about this and he would tell you just how invisible he feels. That's the thing. He's not asked anything about his disability. He's ignored.
But doesn't it all come back to one simple fact, that really the message, if someone was listening to this, say that taxi driver that keeps asking me if I'm enjoying my day at my club, you know, my reaction to that is usually, because we're all different, we're not one homogenous group of people. Now, we've said that a lot here at RNIB, and, you know, we say it all the time, I feel like I say it all the time, and it's because it's true. We're just not,
yeah,
we're different people.
My mum absolutely loves telling me when there's another blind person in the street. She's like, oh, there's a blind guy just walked past. Oh, this guy with a dog,
there's another
just
one
past.
Yeah.
And I went to London. So after I first started this job and I went to London to do some of my training, I was at Judd Street. And we went to the bar at the corner of Judd Street. I met my mum. And she was like, oh, there's a blind guy who's just walked in and he's getting a drink and he's sat on his own. Should we go and sit with him? I said, probably not. No, because we don't know him. Do you want to go and sit with any of these other strangers in this bar? Probably not. Leave him alone. And she does it all the time. I don't know them. I don't, you know, there's a very weak chance that I know who this person is. We're not friends. We don't speak. And just because we're blind doesn't mean we've got everything in common. Actually, I might not like them.
But isn't
That's
it the
fine.
Worst? Isn't it the worst thing though when you say, you have that rant to your mum or to your friend, and you say, I mean, you know, I don't know every blind person in the world, and then all of a sudden the person says, Stephen. And then suddenly you're best friends again.
And then you're like, excuse
really?
Me, do I know you? No, so don't talk to me.
Well, you know, it's been such an interesting conversation this week. It really has, because you know, again, this is what it's all about here on the Weekly Connect. Just getting this off our chest and giving us a chance to to say these things. Natasha, you know, I know you do a lot of work. I just want to give you some a chance here to say something about your role in all of this here at RNIB. You're based, where are you based again for people who want to maybe get in touch?
Leeds. Lovely, lovely Leeds.
Lovely Leeds.
Lovely Leeds. But I cover Yorkshire and the Humber. There are my counterparts across the country in the northwest, northeast, London, southeast, southwest, and across the Midlands, and then in Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland as well. So there'll be a community facilitator coming to you soon. Basically, we just work to help you guys to do anything that you want to do, really, whether it be you want to start running and we can help you join a running group. So whether that be to help someone, you know, be taught as a guide runner or finding a group near you, or you might want to meet other blind and partially sighted people who really like cooking. You can put you in touch with Jill and you can chat about cooking. You know, there's plenty of options. You know, you might be listening to this and think, you know what I really want to do? I want to make a cookbook and I'm visually impaired. We could find other people who want to do that and you can do that project with them people. You know, the possibilities are insanely endless. And no question is too random. No thought is too weird. The better, the bigger. Go for it. Do anything you want to do. And that's what I think is fabulous.
I think you're opening up quite a lot there, but okay.
Worms, but isn't that lovely?
Of course it is. Of course it is.
Would it be inappropriate for me just to say finally that I just absolutely love your accent. I love the North of England accent. It's just wonderful.
I hate my accent. I absolutely hate it. And I record things for this radio show and then I listen to them and I think, oh, that's awful. And one of my favourite emails I got from Stephen was, the interview was great, but I cut you out. It's like, yes!
Well, there were other reasons for that. It wasn't your accent, I promise you. But listen, just a quick note. How can people get in touch with you in your area?
With me? Straight on me.
Yep.
You can email me at natasha.marsay@rnib.org.uk, and Marsay is MARSAY. You can call me if for your sins on 01133 862 813. Otherwise, you can add the Yorkshire and Humber Facebook page, which is RNIB Connect Yorkshire and Humber, and that is it. Otherwise, if you want to find your community facilitator near you, you can get in contact with the Peterborough team, who can put you in contact with the facilitator near you, or you can go on the RNIB Connect website, where you can blog and chat to people and find out all of our contact details as well.
Natasha Marcy, thank you
for being here. You are more than welcome.
It was great to talk to you this week, Natasha. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And that is it for this week's Weekly Connect. Jill, what another show? Another one?
I know. I think we covered a lot of ground there.
I think we did. Back again with more next week. If it's 1 o'clock,
it's the Weekly Connect.